Good evening. Recently, somebody said that he didn't care at all for my Dharma talks. And this person said, well, I think Zen should just be about daily life. I was surprised because I had the feeling that's what I was always talking about, was daily life. But the person didn't think so, so I've had to examine my conscience. I'm not talking enough about daily life. This evening, what I was going to talk about, I suddenly started to think, oh, maybe this isn't daily life. Maybe I shouldn't talk about it. But you guys can decide that. I was reflecting on something my teacher said at one of our recent seminars. He said that it was his basically his vow, something like not to become embroiled in essences and attributes. Does that sound like daily life to you? Essences and attributes are what the world is made of, that is, our world. The world of sentient beings. The only thing is, there aren't any, actually. Not just objects, but people, persons, are actually without essence or attribute, ultimately speaking. Our practice is to see about ceasing to relate to this created world in the usual way, that is, assuming essences and attributes in everything and everyone that we meet. So an essence, of course, is to assume that this bead has some ultimate fundamental quality that distinguishes it from everything else. That is, its essence. And the usually deeply unconscious assumption is that there is such an essence that exists. Such that these three beads are all completely unique and, most importantly, exist by and of themselves. So, in other words, you could take one of these beads, subtract the rest of the entire universe, and the bead would still be the bead. Of course, Buddhism teaches just the opposite. Furthermore, in addition to its essence, this bead could be said to have attributes. It's of a certain size, it's round, it's smooth, it has blue and white colors, it has a hole through the middle, and so forth. And these attributes are assumed to be somehow permanently associated with the essence of this bead. And people are related to in the same way, although in a more complicated fashion. So, people, that is, beings, have essences, and they have attributes, and their essence is somehow fixed and permanently associated with that particular being. Buddhism, of course, teaches that that's not so. But that is what they call mere appearance. And that essences and attributes are mere aspects of what's called dependent co-arising. In other words, what appears to be an essence of something is actually coordinated appearance of factors which rely on other factors and in turn on other factors in basically an infinite series. And in some forms of Buddhism, practitioners are presented with the fairly serious intellectual challenge of assuming an essence and then trying through mental effort actually to find it so that you can say, there it is, I found it. And of course, this can't be done. And the purpose of the exercise is actually to exhaust that faculty of mind that constantly assumes and grasps after essences and attributes. And usually, at least in, for instance, the Dalai Lama's school of Tibetan Buddhism, this is what the practitioner does at first. And then, there develops a kind of, at least an intellectual appreciation of the fact that things do not have any essence that can be found. And this is usually followed by the practice of Tantra, which from their point of view is held to be necessary to address the profoundly unconscious assumptions we have about how the world is constructed. In this Dharma family, we just do Zazen, which is its own powerful solvent for these unconscious assumptions. So you may notice as your practice goes on, and as you encounter these teachings over and over again, that your certainty about what you for a long, long time took for granted about the world has been permanently shaken. And this is an excellent thing. And this is the doorway to liberation. So my teacher said, yes, my vow is I will not embrace or invest in essences and attributes as I move through the world. And he also said that he does not know and could not know what that would look like. In other words, the commitment, the vow not to deal in essences and attributes, someone might think, well, yeah, and then you'll relate to people or things in a certain way or behave in some certain fashion. But actually, this can't be known ahead of time. And he also said, and in addition, it had better not be known ahead of time. We had better not try to know it ahead of time. And that this sort of not knowing mind that is attempting always to free itself from assumptions is the correct foundation for the practice of the precepts. Inevitably, the karmic path of involvement with these assumed essences and attributes will lead us, so to speak, astray and into behavior, both inner and outer, that is karmically, we might say, radioactive. So if we look at our lives and our behavior, we realize that we do tend to proceed on the basis of these assumptions. For instance, you may run into somebody that you know, and the assumption that you know them somehow, know who they are, you got their number, channels and in a sense distorts your behavior with them and your relationship. We generally don't meet people whom we have known for some while as though we were encountering them afresh each time. But instead, on the basis of past history and a whole variety of assumptions, one of them being that this being and I permanently exist based on our respective essences. Sentient beings rarely call that to mind consciously. So this is what is meant by a kind of deeply unconscious assumption about how the world is constructed and how it works. Believe it or not, I am talking about daily life, or at least trying to. But it's daily life, kind of, you know, from the perspective of the Buddhas. Talking about daily life from the perspective of sentient beings is what we do all the time. So maybe in our Dharma practice, we should see if we can talk about and think about mind and objects and experience in a little different way. I suppose in cafes here and there you could hear people talking about essence and attribute. But this perspective that there aren't any such things, except in the kind of in the provisional, potentially co-arising sense, is not really a philosophical position, although it may seem to be. In fact, it's a it's both a meditation instruction and a product of clear seeing of reality. So you can do this yourselves, you know, as you move through your day and encounter objects such as your morning cup of coffee. You can actually watch how you relate to this thing as though it had a fixed essence. And then you can also do a little mental ceremony, very quick, easy ceremony of letting that go. Notice, oh, I actually think this cup of coffee really exists. I do believe that. You can also then simply say, okay, I'm actually going to renounce that. And you kind of invite a cup of coffee into your zazen in that moment. In the deep stability and quiet of our sitting practice, we're not actually giving rise to these, giving energy or credence to these assumptions. They simply arise and pass away moment after moment, like our breathing. And this finally becomes the solvent of these entrenched beliefs, like water dripping on stone. Until finally you may notice that you're actually prepared to enter and move in the world without the belief that things are fixed, stable, permanent entities. And that includes you. This might be a little freaky at first, you know. Like, what do you mean? I need my essence. What are you talking about? I need to be a permanent entity or it'd be a problem. Actually, it's not a problem. It's, again, it's the door of liberation. So I've been kind of watching this contrast recently, moving through my day and noticing the difference between how I relate to a world of supposed essences and attributes when I have made the assumption that I am a fixed, permanent point of reference in the universe, and when I have actually let that go. And there's a subtle and quite wonderful difference. It's possible that if somehow or other we were confronted all at once and without much preparation with our actual nature, we might become upset and confused. Sometimes back in the heyday of psychedelic drugs, sometimes people would consume a substance and without realizing it, were presented with a vision of the universe entirely in flux and without stable essences and attributes. And they were kind of upset and caused problems for them because, well, they weren't yogically prepared for that vision. Other people had that vision, thought it was pretty cool, and then spent many years trying to get it back. That didn't work either. So the process, if you like, of practice is also a process of yogic preparation for a view of reality such as the Buddhas might have. This sitting process, the second abbot of Zen Center said, changes the body on a cellular level. I think there's some substantiation of that. Some of these neuroscientific people are find that such things as meditative practice and so forth actually change the body. So as Dogen says, the gate of liberation stands open. Through it, you might say, we see a universe unbelievably dynamic and constantly changing. And it includes us completely. And the germ of suffering is the very, very deep and primordial resistance to that, which is necessary in order to give rise to the notion of a permanent being. So this is basically Buddha's insight, and it's been around now for quite a while and has been elaborated on in various fashions, but its fundamental power or basis has not changed. And there are various ways to relate to that insight. Ours is through the powerful practice of just sitting. And in that practice, we don't... we take a somewhat specific physical posture, cross-legged or in a chair or even lying down or even walking, but one that allows the body-mind to relax in the face of things as they are. That is, without attributes and essences that are fixed. And eventually, in a manner of speaking, the ballast kind of shifts, you know, it's like a, what's that thing, the seesaw. And eventually, the ballast shifts from the side of being convinced that the world is built up of fixed essences and attributes to the abandonment of that being convinced. And then the seesaw shifts. And you're, well, and then you discover yourself on the path of the Buddhas. Again, without particularly knowing what that's going to look like or what you're going to do about it, it doesn't give you a plan. It gives you a very wide opening. So I think I would recommend that that we all kind of take on this vow not to be seduced by belief in essences and attributes, and watch for that dynamic in our life, in our world. And begin to notice the difference between relating to the world on that basis and relating to the world as though there were no fixed essences and attributes. At first, this is just a notion, you know, an idea. But it starts to permeate one's tissues over time and change our behavior. Again, it'd be better not to try and figure out how that's going to look. Don't try to guess ahead of time. Okay, suppose I didn't believe in essences and attributes. How would I be? You know, would people be throwing themselves at my feet? Would I suddenly become rich? You know, win the lottery? I don't know. Don't worry about that stuff. Just let it unfold as it unfolds. And then, as they say, you are standing eyebrow to eyebrow with the Buddhas and ancestors, which is what Buddhism is all about. It's not about worshipping Buddha. It's about discovering for ourselves Buddha's insight. And then the precepts of the Buddhas and ancestors take on a new life. They reveal how this person is, as they say, a bridge in the world for crossing over, and how critical our behavior is, how crucial. Even the little things that we do, so important. We can't know how to be a bridge in the world for crossing over. We can't know that. Our vow to be such a thing is unburdened of assumptions and prior plans. Well, how can that be? Well, as we relate more and more to beings and objects without the burden of assumptions about essences and attributes, you'll see. You'll see how that unfolds. But you can't know ahead of time. As I'm talking, I'm periodically fretting. Am I talking about daily life enough? I think I am. At least I'm trying to. But as I refrain from telling the person who was complaining about my Dharma talks, again, it's daily life from the point of view of the Buddhas. That's how they see daily life. We may want to hear a different kind of message, one that comforts us and confirms us in our life as it already is. And the Buddha's message does that, but in an unexpected fashion. Buddhas tell us our lives as they are quite fine as they are. However, do we actually know them? Do we actually know what our life is? And in order for that knowing to arise, to be given birth to, we may have to relinquish certain habitual assumptions, certain comforting beliefs. We may have to let that go. And so in sitting practice, we celebrate that over and over again, that letting go. So we take our position, sit ourselves down, and let the whole of the baggage fall away, moment after moment. And as we do that, as I say, the body-mind changes. So you needn't worry. Just have some confidence in your own practice, and definitely have confidence that the Buddhas weren't out to deceive anybody, that they were speaking what they knew to be the truth. That way, when we engage in our practice, in our sitting, we can abandon worry. We can cease to fret about, am I doing this right? You know, what if the Buddha was wrong? All that sort of stuff. Of course, the Buddha said, oh, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Figure it out for yourself. So we can do that. It's not a matter of figuring it out exactly, but we can allow our view of reality to get clearer and clearer. Do you have some questions?
Yes. Yeah.
That's one.
kind of. Could you talk more about the bridge? I kind of lost the I couldn't relate to that metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how it relates. How that. I thought you might be saying that the practice it would make us aware of the importance for our action.
Mm-hmm.
And the bridge. So.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think I said that Dogen, in his Kyoju Kaimon essay on the precepts, says that there's a bridge in the world for crossing over, and that's you. You're the bridge for beings to cross over to the end of suffering. And you can't know what that looks like. You can't have some plan about it. The precepts are a way of embodying the truth of that in the world of sentient beings. And then you become the bridge. Does that make any sense? Again, a bridge doesn't exactly know it's a bridge. It just does what it does. So we're like that. Yeah.
Thanks. Uh-huh. Is it that there are no attributes and essences, or that there are no immutable attributes and essences?
Yeah, it's that, usually, at least from certain perspectives, essences and attributes are assumed to be permanent, but in fact they're not. So again, it's not that there is nothing that could be called an essence, but whatever that is not fixed and does not exist from its own side. As I said, this each bead has, you could say, has certain attributes, but they do not exist, and the bead they pertain to do not exist from their own side. They do not exist apart from the entire universe of causes and conditions that are supporting that. Therefore, there is no fixed essence. That's the teaching.
But there can be an unfixed or a changeable essence.
Well, yeah, if that's useful for us to say. I'm not sure in the case of this bead what that would be. What is its unfixed essence?
Clay.
Clay? Huh? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. As long as that doesn't tempt us into a fixed view about its essence.
The other thing was that I have a friend of many decades who seems to me to have
Right.
So looking at it from the other side of being perceived as having fixed is the set of essences and attributes.
It's kind of imprisoning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you able to relate to that person as though that person did not have fixed essences and attributes? So that might help him or her step out of that cage. Oh, I wasn't fishing for compliments. I was just. The karma of our daily life tends to be extremely focused on both future and past, constantly drawing us into speculation about the future or rumination on the past. And the karmic impulse of that is quite strong. This is one thing that makes it difficult for us to sit down and be still in the midst of the present moment. Something's always like, you know, well, what about thus and so, or I have to take care of something else, or what if such and such happens? This is constantly drawing us into a fantasized future. And it's especially difficult if there's some pressure in the present. For instance, we're uncomfortable or ill. I know that. It happens a lot to me. And then we try to squirm away from what can't be squirmed away from, namely this present moment. Buddhism teaches, you know, pretty much, at least especially in Zen, that so-called body and mind are one suchness. So Buddhism doesn't teach that there's a body with a soul in it. It doesn't really teach that. It teaches that this whole manifestation is one suchness, one truth. So usually if we're burdened by great anxiety about what's going to happen, we should notice and withdraw our attention from getting ahead of ourselves and drawing ourselves into the future. So come back to this body-mind now. And if we can't respond to what our physician requires right away, well, too bad. Yes? Too bad, doc. Sorry. Can't happen. Yes, yes, I see. Well, it can't happen. Can't happen. That's tough. And, you know, you're not obliged to conform to the doctor's vacation plans. Like, maybe you need another doctor. It's like, if it's that critical, then how about, you know, if he has to go on vacation or she has to go on vacation, then how about maybe another physician who isn't going on vacation right now? So other people also try to get us to live more in the future, or even the past, depending on the circumstances. As Breck was saying, someone who got to know you in the 70s, and you're still that person to them. It's like a past focus. So either of those orientations pulls us into a kind of unbalanced state, which doesn't feel right. It always feels uncomfortable. All of us, sooner or later, will have to confront the fact that this dependent co-arising is going to dissolve. One way or another, sooner or later, that's going to happen. And my favorite way of studying that fact is to be still. To resist the temptation to either run away from it or make it different, or something. Just to be still with that. To sit in that suchness, that truth. That is what helps me. So that's what I recommend to others. Yes. Thank you.
Could you say a little bit more about the process? Yeah, thank you, Greg. Could you say a little more about the process of noticing detachment or involvement attributes in that?
Well, we have to have some intention to do that. And I certainly don't remember to do that all the time. I notice myself relating, or it looks like I spent most of the day relating to fixed essences and attributes. It's like, okay, well, how about as of now, I renew my vow not to do that, to be differently in the world. And then it's just a matter of noticing exactly what's happening. And if one is tempted to indulge in the imputation of fixed essences, you can see it happen. You can also see there's no basis for it. The more you look, the more you realize it is not substantiated. And when various Buddhists talk about our constant habit of imputing things onto reality, they're not kidding. That's what we do all the time. We've built a whole world out of it. And you can actually watch it happen.
The way to clear the way to watch it happen is to be in the presence as much as possible.
Well, yeah, you can't be anywhere else, so that's easy. You know, we're always in the present, so that's good. It's just a matter of becoming familiar with what it means to observe clearly. And in so doing, one can see the tendency to engage in imputations, to plaster reality with stuff that doesn't stick, and to live as though it did stick. That's sentient beings. Yes?
Doesn't the failure to impute certain attributes upon the reality you perceive turn it into a wilderness?
I'm sorry, you said because of the failure?
Yes, if you were to fail to impose at least some attributes upon your perception, don't you turn your world into a wilderness?
Mean into an indecipherable mess?
Yeah.
Oh. The instruction isn't to suddenly approach the world as though one had been lobotomized. Right? That's not what this is about. This is about noticing the process of imputation. It doesn't mean we're suddenly going to forget how to drive a car or make breakfast. It just means that in the midst of those ordinary activities, we'll see how we assume over and over again that what we're dealing with is fixed and unchanging, and so are we. It's a matter of noticing. Right? This is what I mean by clear observation. So it won't make it impossible to get things done. Certain psychoactive substances will make it impossible to get things done. But as far as I know, Buddhist practice does not do that. Yeah.
Just in that light thing you were talking about, when I've experienced it, it's been that I've put myself there. For instance, someone might say, the sky is red. And of course, my big student said, the sky is not red.
Mm-hmm.
But it's possible it's red. And so mm-hmm. It's putting my own fixedness on it, or my own perception of things that I'm supposed to be a certain way,
mm-hmm.
that harbors me from being able to let go of those attributes and
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, Dogen says in Genjo Koan that to meet the 10,000 things with the self is delusion. That the 10,000 things manifest as self is awakening. So I think maybe what you're talking about is to carry the self forward and encounter myriad things. This is what he says. This is a way of referring to sentient beings' way of delusion. Right? Does that sound like what you're talking about?
Yeah.
So the tendency is to carry a self into the world and encounter beings and objects. In fact, the only self that there is comprised of the 10,000 things manifesting as us. So this is you might say, subtle but critical shift of perspective. And practice supports this. Supports the change of perspective, which permits not carrying a self forward and trying to leave its stamp on all the 10,000 things, which is what we're constantly trying to do as sentient beings. Buddhas realize that there is no self outside of the 10,000 things. And our practice is oriented that way. Yeah, sure. Naturally. All the time. Which is where vow and intention come in. To renew that over and over changes things. Changes the life stream. Well, perhaps that's enough failure to talk about daily life for now. Thank you all very much for your practice and for being here tonight.